This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Welcome to the People Speak Radio Show. I'm your host, Michael Strasser. The People Speak normally airs every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time on the BBS Radio Network. You can participate tonight during the show with call-in questions for our guests toll-free in the U.S. and Canada. Phone number is 1-888-429-5471. That is 1-888-429-5471. We have a very special guest tonight. Our guest is Hatem Abudeya from the Arab American Action Network. Since 1999, he has been with them and was appointed executive director in 2003. He's the son of Palestinian immigrants who are leaders of the Arab community in Chicago. He was born there, coached basketball, baseball. He was an administrative assistant in Mather High School before joining the AAAN, vice president of the board of directors in the Coalition of the African, Arab, Asian, European, and Latino Immigrants of Illinois in 2006. He's a founding advisory board member of the National Network for Arab American Communities and sits on the National Coordinating Committee of the United States Palestine Community Network. Today, he's with us speaking in behalf of Rasmia Odeh, who's a leading member of Chicago's Palestinian Arab and Muslim communities. She has been persecuted. In 1970, she was convicted of terrorist bombing by the Israeli government, served 10 years, and recently she was convicted on immigration fraud. Hatem, can you hear me? How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm doing very well. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. Is there anything you would like to add right now?
No, I think we can get to it. That was a pretty good intro.
Oh, thank you very much. You know, I just kind of wanted to go into her side of the story regarding what happened in 1969 and the conviction in 70.
Yeah, I think let me first say that a conviction in an Israeli military court should always have quotations around that word. You know, it stats by the Israeli military itself, as well as all the main reputable human rights organizations in Palestine and in the Arab world, and the Israeli human rights organizations as well, talk about the lack of due process in Israeli military courts. 99.4% of Palestinians who come in front of an Israeli military court get convicted. So, you know, we always put quotes around the word conviction when we talk about this case. And specifically in Rasmia's case, she was viciously, physically, and sexually tortured into a confession. And that confession was what we used to convict her. So she never perpetrated any crime. She was not responsible for the bombings that they alleged her to be responsible for. You know, she spent 10 years, 10 of the best years of her life in an Israeli prison, and consistently experiencing the racism and the torture and the physical, emotional, and psychological violence that all Palestinian prisoners, political prisoners, have to deal with.
Right. They basically view them as animals, and that's how they try to treat them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the issue of political prisoners is you know, what we believe, people in the Palestine National Movement believe is as important as any other issue for us, as important as the right of return or the end of occupation and colonization. We believe it's so essential, because if we allow the discourse that criminalizes our prisoners, our political prisoners, then it's a natural jump to then criminalize the resistance, and then another natural jump to criminalize the national liberation movement itself. So it's essential that we refuse the criminalization of our prisoners. It's essential that we defend them at every turn. It's essential that we talk about their freedom, expose the Israeli military court system, the Israeli prison administration system, to the rest of the world. And there's a lot of fantastic organizations that are doing that, especially Ad-Damir in Palestine and Samidun in Canada and a bunch of others in Europe and the Arab world and in the United States.
What was the type of trial she was given? It was effectively a military tribunal, right?
Yeah, that's essentially what it was. You know, it is folks in the Israeli military that are adjudicating a case in front of other folks in the Israeli military who are the prosecution, who are the witnesses. You know, of course, they use the concept of secret evidence all the time. I don't know if they use secret evidence specifically in Rosmia's case. I would assume that they did, because they use it a lot when it for what they call national security cases. And in fact, you know, we started using secret evidence in the United States after September 11th as well, even though most of our constitutional rights organizations and advocacy institutions talked about how it was a violation of the Constitution. But you know, you don't really get a fair trial. And this is not just us saying this as the Rosmia Defense Committee or as the United States Palestinian Community Network, which is the lead community organization working on the campaign, or as her lawyers. This is, you know, what Israeli human rights organizations, Palestinian human rights organizations have always said about the Israeli military court system, is that it lacks due process. And that stat that I just mentioned a couple minutes ago of, you know, 99.4% of Palestinians that come before the Israeli military court getting convicted, I mean, that speaks for itself, I believe.
Well, could you explain what the nature of secret evidence is?
Yeah, essentially secret evidence is evidence that the prosecution has that it claims is material, which means, you know, essential to make its case, whatever that case may be, and that the judge gets to see it and hear it, and the judge gets to see and hear the evidence and any witnesses of this secret evidence. But the defense does not. It's been used in a couple prominent cases, at least one prominent case in the United States, too. There was secret evidence used in the case of Mohammed Salah, a Chicagoan who had spent a few years in an Israeli prison, and then again as a political prisoner. And then when he came to the United States, he was indicted in a RICO case, actually a conspiracy case. He was acquitted of all of the quote unquote terrorism charges, but he was convicted of a lesser charge and ended up spending about 8 months in a federal prison here. But Israeli witnesses, military from Israel, were flown to the United States to testify in his case in front of the judge, but his defense was not able to hear that evidence or cross-examine those witnesses. So that's the, you know, I mean, without us being lawyers, that description of secret evidence makes you is pretty convincing that should not be allowed and that it doesn't seem very fair for the defendant.
Well, that's pretty cringeworthy hearing that, you know, they can't even give themselves, you know, any semblance of a proper defense.
Right. And that it doesn't say, I'm not saying that there's secret evidence in every case. And I'm not saying that the only evidence that is put forth is secret evidence. I'm saying that it's used a lot. And it's one of the main reasons why we believe that military courts, Israeli military courts, are a massive violation of due process. And, you know, it's the Israeli military that is part of the national security apparatus who are sitting as the judges in these military courts and are hearing the case from prosecutors who are also part of the national security apparatus. And so nobody holds them accountable. Even the Israeli public doesn't hold them accountable because it's all a part of the national security apparatus. We've seen what that has done to our society in the United States. This claim that we've got to give up some of our rights, a lot of our rights, because we have to strengthen national security. You know, that is, Israel has been that way since 1947. Israel has been an entire society that is dominated by the national security apparatus. And so the public does not challenge it. There is no democratic discourse about it. It's just the Palestinians that are being affected. And so the public is not up in arms. And then when the public has been up in arms on very, very, very few occasions, it's easy for demagogues to shut them up pretty quickly by talking about national security and talking about you know, existential issues. It's not Israel's existence that is under threat. It's actually the Palestinians' existence that is under threat because of the policies of colonialism and occupation and really state terrorism from Israel.
Well, they even have the, you know, tourists to Israel just totally up in arms and just scared that a rocket's going to hit them wherever they're at. And it's beyond ridiculous. And they use propaganda like this to keep the military over there just in its current position. So could you please go into detail about, you know, the true nature of Razmia's political activism?
Yeah. So Razmia, when she was just a young woman, before she was even an adult, at 16, 15 or 16 or so, she began doing some organizing with the refugee population. So she was born in 1947 in a town called Lifta, which is directly adjacent to Jerusalem. It was one of the first Palestinian villages that was depopulated in 1947 and 48 when Israel was established. So she was a refugee at 1 year old upon the establishment of Israel in May of 1948. And so so Lifta is a historic name and village in the Palestinian consciousness, one in which a lot of young people from that village, you know, became leaders in the struggle for Palestinian rights, and she ultimately was one of those people as well. She is considered one of our most iconic leaders, Palestinians, especially Palestinian women. She had, you know, really essentially she has been an organizer for close to 50 years. So she started doing just regular, you know, refugee resettlement work, working with refugees in Jerusalem, where she grew up, and in Ramallah. And so, you know, the occupation, then the war of 1967 begins. The rest of Palestine is then occupied. At that time, at that point, she's only 20 years old. For 3 or 4 years, she's been doing this refugee resettlement work. And now, you know, her home was demolished. She saw friends and family killed in the war. You know, she was absolutely devastated. Her family was, you know, maybe middle class when Israel was established, when they became refugees. And then in 67, again, they were relatively comfortable before the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. And so she decided that, you know, she needed to do more, and she started organizing even more, and this was, she was doing some educational work with young people, some more refugee resettlement work, some International Red Cross, Red Crescent work, and that's when she was picked up in a massive sweep in 1969. And we don't know exactly how many people were arrested, but what the Israelis do, what they've been known to do, is that if there is, you know, an operation or an attack like the bombing in 1969, what they'll do is they'll just sweep entire villages and entire areas where there are organizers, where there are people who you know, are resisting and people who are, you know, part of the movement to support Palestinian rights. And they'll just arrest everyone. You know, Israel, is not bound by any due process when it comes to these arrests. Nobody gets Mirandized. The right to remain silent, the right to an attorney, all of those sort of things. They just sweep hundreds of people. And in the case of the sweep that picked Rasmiya up, there were probably a few hundred, if not as many as five. There's differing numbers, but we know there were hundreds at least. And then they just, you know, they torture until they get confessions. And they tortured people who then claimed that Rasmiya participated, and then they tortured her, of course, until she confessed. And the reason why she confessed is because not only had they raped her, and sexually assaulted her. They also threatened to force her father, who was an American citizen, to rape her himself. At that moment, I mean, this is really, really hard to even talk about, in all honesty, let alone hear this story. But at that point, she could not handle it any longer, did not want to subject her father to what he was being subjected to, and she confessed. And so she was convicted in 1970 and was released in 1979 in a prisoner swap.
So there was an American citizen involved with this, and the United States government still didn't get involved like it should to protect the liberties of American citizens abroad.
Absolutely. That's a good point. It's really, really important to know that. I mean, Rosamilla was not a citizen at the time, but her father was. And it's interesting because when we get to the current conditions of the story, we see that there are, you know, the maybe claims from the State Department, claims from, you know, at that time it was called INS, Immigration and Naturalization Services. It's now the Department of Homeland Security. Claims that they didn't know anything about Rosamilla's past and the time that she spent in prison and all of, as a political prisoner. And, you know, that is all untrue, because her father went to the U.S. Embassy and he reported what had happened to his daughter, and he reported what had happened to him, because he was physically assaulted as well. So the U.S. government, some government agency, the embassy, the consulate, knew this information, knew that this daughter of a U.S. citizen was in an Israeli prison, knew that this daughter of a U.S. citizen had made claims of vicious sexual and physical torture. And then, you know, 40 years later, over 40 years later, they claim that they didn't know any of it, and that and then they bring this preposterous indictment about related to immigration fraud.
Wow, that seems awfully convenient. But I'm wanting to – we have Mike in California asking. Well, first I'm going to preface this by asking, did she have actual involvement in the PFLP?
No, she did not.
But someone asked, Mike in California asked, can Hatem explain what the PFLP is? It's portrayed by Israelis and the U.S. as a terror group.
So this is what I'll say. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the Islamic Jihad, Hamas, at one point Fatah itself, which is the movement that is essentially in control of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. As we know, the historic Fatah is the Fatah of Yasser Arafat, the leader of the Palestine Liberation Organization. But the PLO was made up of a number of different factions, including the PFLP, the DFLP, the Palestinian People's Party, Fatah, and a number of others. Later on, we saw two additional forces come onto the scene in Palestinian society, Hamas and Islamic Jihad. So if we believe that Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Fatah, and the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, those five forces represent the majority of the Palestinian political viewpoints in Palestine, at one point, all five were considered terrorist organizations by Israel. Currently, three of them are, and three of them are on the U.S. State Department list of terrorist organizations. So essentially, what the U.S. and Israel is trying to say is that, you know, between 60 and 80% of the Palestinian population is terrorist because they support one or more of these terrorist organizations. So, you know, I mean, there are different definitions, of course. The U.S. has a definition of terrorism that is different than the definition that the Palestinians or people in the Arab world or people in the vast majority of the rest of the world who would probably say that these organizations are, you know, liberation fighters and not terrorists. But yes, the PFLP in 1997 were placed on the U.S. State Department terrorist list along with Hamas and the Islamic Jihad. And so, you know, that's another way that the United States is able to criminalize, again, what we talked about earlier with political prisoners. In this case, you criminalize the people's organizations, whether it's the PFLP or Hamas or the Jihad or in the past Fatah or the DFLP. You criminalize the people's organizations. You're essentially criminalizing the people and you're criminalizing their liberation movement, which is why in some places in Belgium, it's part of a bill, I think, that came up in their parliament. Other parts of Europe, there's real discourse about this. There's real discussion about whether or not these organizations should be on a terrorist list. But of course, you can't have that conversation in the United States, especially in the in this horrible anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant world, that society that we live in right now.
Has there been any media coverage whatsoever of the case of Rasmia?
There has been a little bit. It hasn't been great coverage. Some of it has been good. You know, some of it, you know, they've been forced to cover it, you know, the way it has transpired. So they weren't able to do much editorializing. But, you know, the Detroit Free Press, because the trial was in Detroit, the Detroit Free Press has been pretty much on it. They've written some things that have sounded like an Israeli or U.S. government press release, but they've been okay, relatively balanced. The Arab American News in Dearborn have really been good.
Well, Hatem, can you hold on to that thought for a second?
Yeah, sure.
We're going on to break here. I'm your host, Michael Strasser, and we'll be right back with our guest, Hatem Abudaya, and audience questions after this message break.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
With over 150 million registered users, PalTalk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 PalTalk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
You are listening to the People Speak radio show. I'm your host, Michael Strasser, and we're back with our guest, Hatem Abudeya, tonight. So, could you pick up where you left off on the nature of these different groups?
Yeah, on the nature of the media coverage.
Oh, that's right. Yes, we were talking about the media coverage that was happening in the United States.
Yeah, so just to go back for a second, you just reminded me, I'm not sure I maybe came to a good conclusion for the listeners, but, you know, the criminalization of these organizations, the placing them on terrorist lists, it's a way to criminalize the Palestinian resistance and to criminalize our national liberation movement. So, you know, it's rejected, of course, in Palestine and in the Arab world, and it's starting to get rejected in a lot of other places around the world as well. It's a discourse that is not allowed here, really, in the United States. So that's that in terms of the resistance organizations, but the coverage, the Free Press was sometimes not so accurate in their coverage. Sometimes, parroting the Israeli line on the story. And the U.S. prosecution's line on the story. The Arab American News was much, much better. AP, actually, some of the AP stories were good and others were not very good at all. One of the things that we were upset with in terms of the AP coverage is that they really ignored us, when I say us, meaning the Rasmiya Defense Committee. I believe an important aspect of the story is the community support that Rasmiya had. The fact that we formed a defense committee the very day of her arrest, the fact that hundreds of organizations have been a part of this defense committee over the 2 years of this campaign, 2.5 years of this campaign across the country, that we have faith leaders and labor leaders and community-based organizations and civil liberties organizations and legal organizations across the country working on this case, trying to educate their respective communities, raising money for the defense, putting the story out in the blogosphere and on websites and in the press. That's an important element here. Like we put a lot of pressure on the prosecution. We put a lot of pressure on the first judge who had to recuse himself because we had looked at his history and saw how close his relationship was with Israel. We put pressure on Judge Drain after the conviction when he had ordered her to prison. Even though he knew that we were filing for an appeal, she spent a month in prison, 3 weeks of them in solitary confinement. And really, it was us organizing all these letters of support from around the country and letters to the judge directly that made him that forced him to release her. And the AP just really ignored the fact that we filled the courtroom every single day of the trial. We filled the courtroom every single day of every hearing, preliminary hearing, that we, you know, had held rallies and protests outside, that major, major figures in the Black Liberation Movement, in the Black Lives Matter movement in Chicago and in Detroit and in Cincinnati when we were there for the appeals spoke on behalf of Rasmiya and in support of Rasmiya. Angela Davis came to Chicago to do an event specifically about Rasmiya's case. She keynoted an event at one of our main universities. Mark Lamont Hill wrote an op-ed in the Huffington Post. Angela Davis again wrote an op-ed in Detroit Free Press. There is massive, broad support for this woman, and for her history as a person who organizes for Palestinian rights, and then her recent history over 10 years of organizing in the United States for the rights of Palestinian and other Arab and Muslim immigrants in Chicago, building from scratch an Arab Women's Committee for our organization, the Arab American Action Network, that now has close to 700 members, you know, a real safe social and political space for new immigrants in this country who often come here with no understanding of how to navigate social safety net services and institutions and things like that. I mean, she's a force of nature. I mean, you know, to be able to do what she did in the Arab world, in Lebanon and in Jordan and in Palestine, where she organized and was a leader in women's organizations and over the years, that, you know, that's one thing. That's very, very impressive, of course, but that's in her native countries and, you know, amongst her people and her culture and her language, who speak her language and all those sort of things. But then to come to the United States and be able to transform our organization, the AAAN, and to transform really organizing for women in this city, for Arab women in this city, it's an incredible, incredible thing that she has accomplished. And for them to try to take that away from her and from us by attacking her legally, using, you know, this phony legal immigration fraud conviction to try to stop her from doing her work, and more importantly, to try to continue to criminalize our heroes and our icons and our leaders, essentially criminalizing our people, meaning Palestinians as a whole, and criminalizing our national liberation movement as a whole. It's a travesty, of justice.
Are you all right with taking a caller?
Absolutely.
Mike in California on line one. You're on
the
air.
Hi, Hatem. You know, I'm glad you explained about the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, because, as you mentioned, it's a group, it's an umbrella for a number of groups, and like you said, a great percentage of Palestinians are nationally supporting them, because they're trying to resist the apartheid of Israel, and that the United States has this on a terrorist list, thereby you know, labeling most of the Palestinians as terrorists. You know, with that in mind, what do you think of someone like Donald Trump, who seems to want to, you know, because there's so many Muslims in Palestine, wants to block all immigration of Muslims to the United States and even go so far as close down some mosques?
Yeah, well, you know, I guess I have to say that I was probably one of those people who thought that Trump was going to be gone from the scene by now. I do believe he's absolutely eminently dangerous, of course. I believe he is, you know, a representative of, you know, this latent racism that we know is in this country, we know has been in this country for hundreds of years. But maybe, you know, we hadn't seen so clearly and so demonstrably until President Obama was elected. I believe that that was a turning point. And this is not an endorsement of President Obama or his policies, but it would be unfair for any progressive, any leftist who is understandably critical of President Obama to not also say that, you know, the Tea Party and Donald Trump and Rubio and Cruz, you know, they all appeared after Obama was elected. And that was, you know, that was some latent racism and horrible hate in this country that came out publicly when a black man was elected president.
Well, I just have a follow-up question. Is the Arab American Action Network doing anything protesting Donald Trump?
You know, we are – Donald Trump is coming to the University of Illinois at Chicago, actually, this Friday. And we are in conversations with a number of our friends in Chicago to be there to greet him.
Okay, we look forward to that. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much for calling, Mike. Good hearing from you. Now, what is the nature of the proceedings in the United States, which has her currently in? Is she currently in prison or?
No, the current situation is this. Rasmiya was convicted of something called unlawful procurement of naturalization. What the prosecution said was that Rasmiya, when she applied for her green card in 1994 and then for her citizenship in 2004, she answered some questions falsely on those applications. The main question that they brought to the proceedings was the question about whether or not you'd ever been convicted of a crime. So there's a number of interesting things that happened legally around those questions. One is that we had heard, you know, from a lot of immigrant rights activists and advocates and, you know, immigrants themselves that a lot of people anecdotally saw that question as being one about whether you've been arrested or convicted of a crime in the United States. So there's an interpretation that, you know, a lot of people think that that's what it means, the U.S., not somewhere else. But in Rasmiya's case, there are two other important, maybe more important factors. One is that obviously she is a survivor of sexual and physical torture. And so she has been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. And so her PTSD does not, for lack of a scientific explanation, does not allow her to think about those traumatic moments in her life. And so having PTSD and having it at the moment that she filled out that application and the moment that she answered the questions from the immigration specialist, she tried to block out those memories. The memory of the arrest, the memory of the conviction, the memory of the rape, the memory of the Israeli soldiers and the Israeli military and the Israeli military corps. The problem is that we were not able to make that argument. We had an expert witness who is world-renowned torture expert, a psychiatrist named Dr. Mary Fabry, who is the one who diagnosed Rasmiya. But the judge would not allow her to testify in front of a jury. He would not allow us to put in the evidence that Rasmiya has post-traumatic stress disorder. He would not allow us to put in the evidence that Rasmiya was a torture survivor, and that she had been tortured into that confession for that fake conviction that Israel talks about.
None of the forms are filled to the best of someone's knowledge. So, you know, if she didn't intentionally do it, and well, there's at least reasonable doubt, she should have been found not guilty of breaking the law.
At the very least, we would have liked to have been able to tell the entire story. You know, the problem is that you are afforded in this system a full defense. We were not afforded a full and fair defense. So because of that, we believe that the jury came back with a conviction. As I mentioned earlier, Rasmiya was imprisoned for about a month. We pressured the judge to get her out, and we were waiting for an appeal throughout that period. We finally argued our appeal. Our attorneys, our two lead attorneys, Michael Deutsch and Jim Fennerty, along with Dennis Cunningham and Bill Goodman and some others, made oral arguments in October of 2015. And just a couple weeks ago, February 25th or 6th, I think, we got a response from the appeals court, and the appeals court agreed with us. The appeals court agreed that Rasmiya was not afforded a full and fair defense, that the evidence about PTSD should have gone in front of a jury, and they basically sent it back to the district court for Judge Drain to come up with an alternate legal explanation for why that evidence should be excluded. If he cannot do that, then we believe that we are going to be able to be afforded a new trial. And that is why we call this right now a partial victory. But if he is not able to come up with an argument back to the appeals court as to why that evidence should be excluded, an alternate legal argument besides the one that he made, which the appeals court said was erroneous, we are going to a new trial with a new jury of Rasmiya's peers who get to hear all of the story, get to hear about the violence of the Israeli military, the unfairness and the lack of due process of the Israeli military court, the rape and the torture and the occupation and Israel's crimes against Palestinians. They're going to hear it all. And we believe strongly that if a jury of her peers are able to hear that entire story, that they're going to acquit her.
Right. I think any well-selected jury would look at that case and say reasonable doubt. I would vote not guilty if I was on that panel. So.
Yeah. I mean, that's what we're hoping. That's what we are hoping. That's what we believe. For people who are interested in reading these kinds of rulings, it's a 23 pager, but it's a really quick read, and it's a fascinating read. We've got it on our website, justiceforlasmia.org. We also are describing there, you know, what we believe the next steps in the case are going to be, a summary of what I just described here, opportunities for people to be able to support her and support the defense. You can also go to USPCN.org, the United States Palestinian Community Network, as the lead organization of Rasmiya Defense Committee, and you can get your updates there, as well as StopFBI.net, which is the other lead organization, the Committee to Stop FBI Repression, the other lead organization in the defense.
Do you see this as more fuel in the future to push the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement?
You know, I'm not sure that this case specifically is fuel to push BDS, but I think this case is related very much to not only BDS, but you know, Palestinian community organizing around our liberation in the homeland. It's a case that everybody is watching across the world. We know that because the decision, the ruling from the appeals court was covered by websites across the Arab world, in Europe, The Guardian, in Africa, of course, in Israel, in Jordan and Palestine and Egypt and Saudi Arabia and everywhere else. People know that this is an incredibly important case because of what I mentioned earlier. This is an opportunity for the United States to try to criminalize the type of work that we do. We see it happening all over the country. Students for Justice in Palestine and other Palestine support student groups are getting attacked by their universities, by the administrations, calling their work in support of Palestinian rights anti-Semitic. Palestine Legal, which is a legal organization that supports these students and other activists who are coming under attack because of their Palestine work, has published a report recently about these attacks on students and others. It's clear, and this is historical. This isn't just Palestinians, because this happened in the Black Liberation Movement. It happened in the Chicano Liberation Movement. And it happened in the American Indian Movement. It happened in the environmental rights movement. A lot of other social justice or liberation movements come under massive attack, from COINTELPRO to, you know, grand juries, come under massive attack because the legal institutions work hand in hand with the political institutions in this country to attack forces that are working for social justice, for human rights, and for national liberation. And so you indict Rasmiya Ouda, you're indicting Palestinians as a whole, you're indicting the Palestine National Liberation Movement, just like indicting Black Panthers did the same to criminalize the Black liberation movement as a whole. That's what grand juries and prosecutors and the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security in this country does. That is their job. That is their responsibility. We win this case. It's a victory for Asmiya, but it's a victory for Palestinians as a whole. And it's a huge, huge loss for Israel and for the U.S. blind support for Israel that everybody else in the world recognizes, except for our government here.
First off, I'm wanting to really thank you for doing this interview today, despite being sick for 3 days. And I'm wanting to also plug in the justiceforrasmiya.org website and also aaan.org website for the Arab American Action Network. Do you have anything else you'd like to say, sir?
Yeah, I want to say that this is a great opportunity. I really appreciate you giving me this this opportunity. I appreciate being able to talk to your listeners. Thank you very much, and stay tuned, everyone, because there's a lot of organizing to be done. You want to bring us to your city to talk about the case. We would love to do that. Contact us through justiceforrasmiya.org. Donate to the defense and keep putting out the real story about Rasmiya and about Palestine.
Thank you very much, sir. You've been listening to the People Speak Radio Show with your host, Michael Strasser. I'd like to thank our guest, Hatem and Abudaya, and remind you of the website, justiceforrasmiya.org. And thank you very much, everybody, for listening and participating. Good night.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief office, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest.